current state on this sunny Friday, April 26th. I'm Joe Lindstroth, current state producer, sitting in for the usual host, Mark Bayshore, who is out today. Coming up this hour, we have a preview of the MSU Symphony's performance this weekend. We'll also hear from a researcher who managed to penetrate the dark underworld of international organ trafficking. It's very interesting. And current state's Emmanuel Berry geeks out with MSU's comic book collection, which is one of the largest in the world. Splat, boom, bat. There we go. But first, a few years ago, writer, photographer, chef Maureen Aboud quit her job, left Chicago, where she lived for 14 years, and moved to San Francisco to follow her passion and attend culinary school. She now writes a popular food blog about Lebanese cuisine called Rosewater and Orange Blossoms from her home in northern Michigan. Her work has appeared in the Huffington Post, the Chicago Tribune, and the Washington Post, just to name a few. Welcome to Current State, Maureen.
Good morning, Joe.
I guess maybe more appropriately, I should say welcome home. You grew up here in Lansing, a graduate of Waverly High School. Listeners might know your surname, Aboud, from your father and your uncle's law firm, and maybe even your grandparents' grocers.
Some deep roots in Lansing, Michigan, and it is so nice to be back.
Does Lansing still feel like home?
Oh, yes. Lansing feels like home for lots of different reasons, and most especially because of the people. There are so many experiences you can have in Lansing, Michigan, that you're not going to have in Chicago or San Francisco when it's where you grew up.
Yeah, exactly.
I was on the phone the other day with someone, a medical person, and it was just, they had sent it to the wrong name. They sent it to my deceased father's name, and I said who he was, Camille Aboud, and the woman said, oh, I loved him.
Wow.
You're not going to have that
in a
big city.
No, you're not. I mean, in fact, that becomes like one of those random chances that that's fantastic. Let's dive in here, you know, in keeping with the same tone of your writing, which is very personal, I just kind of want to get into it. You know, I want to read an excerpt first of an article that you wrote entitled Blueberry Cobbler at the End of a Long Day, which you published last August in the Huffington Post. In the piece, you describe about the moment you realized that your marriage was over, and you went to stay at your sister Peg's condo. And you write, I could hear the sounds of baking going on in the kitchen. Come and measure the flour, Peg said. I wouldn't. Come and mix the berries with sugar, she coaxed. I couldn't. Drop the dough over them then? I had nothing of it until I smelled the berries bubbling and the shortbread crust baking. I lifted my zombie self out of bed and walked to the oven, which could tell I needed a hug. I sat down in front of her with my box of Kleenex and watched the cobbler bake. It might not seem like it, but it's going to be okay, I promise you, Peg said. The oven said so, too. And both of them were right. I mean, that's an exceptionally honest piece of writing, and yet it also makes me hungry. How do you combine the confessional mode of writing and writing about food?
I like what you just said, that it also makes you hungry. And I think we do hunger for lots of things in life. And one of the things that we all hunger for the most is to live an authentic life, an honest life. And when we go through difficult experiences like divorce, death, things that draw us closer to the nitty-gritty of our souls, we have an opportunity to really think about why we're here and what we want to do with our days. So as a writer, I think some of the best things that have happened to me are the most difficult things because they've called me out into a state of vulnerability, a state of honesty, that I think makes my writing better than ever when I do that.
I think I would completely agree. And, you know, I think anyone would say, a writing teacher would say, honesty, be honest, right, with you know. And it just, when I read your blog, it comes out in post after post. It's not just recipes. It's from your heart. It's honesty. And yet there is this combination between your honesty and then food. You know, why do you find your own personal narrative is so intertwined with food?
I think this goes pretty deeply into my cultural heritage because my Lebanese family has always been very close to the table. It's a really important part of our lives, and I could see that evidence ever so clearly when I went to Lebanon for the first time last year.
And we're going to get there.
Okay. Yeah. But I think that I do think that so much of how we share and come together as families, as friends, as communities, is through the enticement of food. And that brings everyone together at the table. And that's where we share. It's where we share love and where we share flavor and taste and enjoy. And it can be real soothing in difficult times. And it can be a terrific celebration. Just like I think so many ethnicities connect that way to one another through food. And then for me, I connect to all kinds of aspects of myself through food. And it's so much fun.
You know, I think as I'm listening to you, I kind of think of the average American sometimes I think misses out on some of that. I mean, we have Thanksgiving, where that's a very obvious one. But sometimes, and I'm guilty of it, you know, I kind of go through and just eat a meal to eat a meal, you know, to stop being hungry. And I think sometimes we forget the community that can surround food and a meal.
We live in a world that tempts us to that lifestyle. So it happens to all of us. We get busy. We have so much going on, so many pulls on our attention, where it could be easy to just not pay attention to the nourishment that is found not only in preparing your own food, but in eating it in a slow way, in a way that you're aware of what you're eating, and then of course sharing it with other people. And I think it's interesting because while we're pulled more than ever away from that, there's so much trending toward an interest in that right now in the culture in general. Cooking your own food, do it yourself.
There is. I mean, you know, Mark Bittman, the well-known New York Times writer, just started a new column and, you know, just bounced to the top of the New York Times this week and about that preparing your own food and ways to do it healthy, simply, and delicious food. We are moving back to that.
It is one of the things I love about being back in Michigan after living in big cities, you know, in Chicago and San Francisco, where the dining out scene is so exciting. And you're really drawn to it, and that is a lot of fun. But then coming back here, where we have some dining options, perhaps not as many as most of us would like to see, cooking at home is really where it's at.
It is. It is. You know, there's the bounty of the farmers markets that I'm waiting for. They're just about to start around here, and I think that's going to be really exciting. And you know, there's a couple restaurants here that are starting to do farm to table in mid Michigan, but this is a burgeoning, growing area in the restaurant business. This is farm to table.
It is, and Michigan is bountiful. It's such beautiful, beautiful farmland and so much wonderful produce in the summer. It's overwhelming.
Okay, so taking this one step further to your cooking, you know, how does cooking connect with you emotionally? You know, how do when you cook, you know, what happens inside of you?
It's an interesting juxtaposition of both introversion and extroversion because you're generally cooking to share. And cooking with others is a lot of fun, too. But there is an internal process that goes on where you're really thinking about what you're doing and you're thoughtful about flavor profiles, what goes together, what flavors work well together, how to, you know, if you have OCD like I do in the kitchen, you want to make sure that every little thing you do is perfect. And, of course, I'm learning not to be that way as much. But it's a real nice balance of an internal process as well as a sharing process.
Do you find that you want to cook something when you're feeling a little angry or frustrated, and that ends up being a different outcome in the kitchen than, say, when you're gleeful and content?
I do like to cook for all different types of emotional experiences that I'm having, for sure.
Is the result different, or is it the same, do you find?
The result can be different, can be worse, if I'm not focusing. If my mind is elsewhere, you can burn things. You can, you know, be hasty. So I would say it's through getting in there and actually cooking that it can get you to a calmer place. But that's where you want to be to produce really, really beautiful, good food. Because out of anger, I think bad things can happen to good people.
That's right. Even in the kitchen, especially around knives and hot stove. So on your blog, Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, and in most of your writing, you reference your Lebanese heritage. You focus on Lebanese cuisine. You talk a lot about your grandmother and your relatives and all these traditions that you learned growing up and eating, and we've just spoken about some of that. And then last year, you went to Lebanon for the first time. I'm really fascinated by that. So up to this point, you connected to your heritage through these stories, through your grandmother, through cooking. Now all of a sudden, there's the Arabic language, a different culture, relatives that you've met for the first time, that sense of place, of being there. I'm fascinated to know how that trip may have changed your sense of self. And then, because they're so interwoven, how it altered your approach to cooking and to Lebanese cuisine.
When you think about a place, imagine a place for so many years as I had my whole life and had heard the stories from all of my grandparents and relatives who'd spent so much time in Lebanon, it becomes this monumental thing. I was excited about it, but also a little anxious, like, I hope this meets my expectations, because I had fantasized about it for so long. But then to actually, and going to the Middle East is not, it's not like going to Italy. You know, there are safety precautions that one, that hover in over one's head in some ways. But then you take a calculated risk. You try to go at the right time. And that's what we did. I went with my mother and my sister, and the place was incredible. And it really opened my mind and my heart to something new. It wasn't in many ways as I imagined. It was different, because I don't know if you can really imagine something like that, a place like that. And to go, and we went up into the villages and met family, cousins that we hadn't met before, but yet we had. Looking into their faces was like, that's my cousin.
Yeah.
And that's an exciting
thing. That's got to be profound. You know, when I think, when I hear you say that, it reminds me of this anecdote about Louis Armstrong when he was traveling the world playing jazz for the State Department. He was sent to Ghana, and he tells this story where he's sitting on the stage ready to play in Ghana, and he looks out and there's tens of thousands of people in Accra who have gathered around to watch him play. And he focuses on this woman, and it looks just like his mother, his dead mother. And he just sits and realizes for the first time, oh my gosh, this is where I'm from. And there's this profound moment to that. And that sounds like what I'm hearing from you, is there was a real profoundness to this experience. How long were you there?
Just a week. I could have stayed months. I wanted to stay longer because it's hard to leave once you get into it. And it's this very profound experience of coming home, yes, to a place where you see all these people who share a culture. Much different from living here. You know, you share a culture, even though there are certainly differences among the people that live within Lebanon, you still feel a kinship, a very strong kinship. And I was never more excited than when people would say to me that they could tell I was Lebanese. And I saw my lookalike here and there on the campus of American University of Beirut, these young women walking by, and I would think, wow, that, you know, that looks like me.
Did you stop in a cafe to write while you're there? Were you feel inspired to write, or did you wait till you came home? Did you have to process it?
I had to process it. I did write in the evenings a little bit. I was trying to deal with photography, too, which was overwhelming as well, because I wanted to take pictures of everything at all times, and I did. Stop the car!
So you've brought a few things to share with us here to taste a little bit in the studio. We know for our listeners you can't quite taste, but maybe you can smell a little bit through your radio. There's some wonderful smells here. But first, we have to start with, I think we have to start with the bread. No? What's so special about Lebanese bread, Maureen?
Well, you'll see, Joe, that I did not bring any utensils for you to taste this food this morning.
I noticed. Nor napkins, so we might have a little messy problem.
The bread works for that, too. But that's because we really don't eat a meal without the bread. And I know that the carb-conscious and the gluten-free among us, that perks their ears. But this is such healthy, wonderful, ancient tradition bread that we have. And what I brought today is some kemej pita bread, but not the pita bread that you might find around the country and in various standard
not
grocery
stores. Not
the thick,
spongier kind, or the kind they split open and stuff in the middle.
Yes.
We're talking about very thin flat
bread. This is elegant, thin, beautiful flat bread.
I mean, we're looking at about eight inch circumference.
Circumference.
I mean, it's with wide flat, a little bubbly.
It's got a beautiful golden hue, and it's ever so soft. It's soft like a baby's bottom. This is bread that you want to eat with the bread. It's that good. And what we do is enjoy it with every bite, taking a piece of the bread off, ripping a piece off, and then scooping up whatever it is on the plate. And that really changes the flavor of what's in your mouth. You have the chewiness of the bread.
Uh-huh.
And your bite, and it slows you down a little too, which I think is good. You can't just go fork in.
Just shovel it in. Yeah. Sit and enjoy each piece. Now, you mentioned in your blog, you mentioned that, I believe it was your grandmother, taught you at a young age, you know, the respect for bread when you drop it on the ground. And there's something you're supposed to do. There's something that kind of highlights some of this. Can you tell a little bit about that?
This is really about respecting and honoring every bit of food in your home, and you wouldn't want to let anything go to waste. And that's really a different era. We throw so much food away now, and we don't think that much about it. It may bother us, but we do it. And there was a time when that really was unheard of. And if you dropped the bread on the floor, that wasn't going to go into the trash. You're going to actually honor it even more, kiss it, mm-hmm. bless it in a way, and continue to eat it.
I'm Joe Lindstroth, Kern State producer, sitting in for Mark Bayshore, and I'm here talking with Lansing native Maureen Aboud. She's a chef and writer. She has a popular food blog about Lebanese cuisine called Rosewater and Orange Blossoms. So we have the bread. And now we're going to move on to, we're going to need something to dip the bread in. I know you wrap bread in bread and eat bread with bread and bread. But how about libni we have here, which essentially looks like a very thick yogurt, almost a cheese.
This is the flavor maker of the plate, labneh. Really, every plate you could eat, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and in between, with a dollop of labneh is going to take you over the moon. This is thickened yogurt, homemade yogurt. Yogurt is so big right now. You're going to be able to get your thick Greek yogurt in the grocery store and enjoy it. That's great. Making it at home is a total pleasure and a really nice practice. But this labneh has been drained. So you take the thinner yogurt, you hang it, as my grandmother did, from the kitchen sink in a handkerchief, a thin, clean handkerchief. Or you can do it in a colander with some cheesecloth. Let as much of the whey drain off as possible, and then you get this thick, luscious spread that is delicious when you scoop it up with a little bit of the bread, as you're doing right now.
And you have sprinkled a little spice on the top. What do you sprinkle on top?
That's nana. That's dried mint.
Okay.
Which is so good on so many things, and especially on the labneh. The white labneh with the sprinkle of dried crushed mint over the top. It's fresh. It's delicious. And it's great to have the dried mint right now before all the fresh nana comes up in our gardens.
You know, I expected it to be much more sour. I've tasted, you know, yogurt, sheep's yogurt in the Balkans, and then even plain yogurt here in the store, and it has a much more sour flavor to this. This is a little bit, but then it's just so smooth, so silky smooth.
Super smooth. And the sheep's milk does yield a much much edgier labneh, and I love that. And you can get your own labneh to be as sour as you like by draining it, leaving it out on the counter. It will ferment.
Now, there's something interesting you had mentioned about the culture. You need a starter culture to make yogurt. And essentially, you can keep the same starter culture going for how long?
You can. This is a little like making sourdough bread. You have a starter that gives you your flavor, your sourness. And with labneh, you always start with a little bit of yogurt from your last batch. If you're lucky enough to have had a last batch that you made yourself, you're going to probably gain a more complex flavor in your yogurt than if you have just a plain yogurt from the grocery store that you start with. But I love the whole idea of the starter, because when you think about making it from batch to batch, it could go back generations, really. I could be eating my great-grandmother's food if I'm using the starter that's been preserved and passed down. I would love to somehow keep that tradition going, keep a starter going. I don't think there's any starter around here that came from Lebanon when everybody immigrated 100 years ago.
That might have been a little tough with refrigeration issues and bringing that
on. It would be neat.
But that is incredibly neat. Just to even think that is possible, though. There's a connection. I mean, you can hear it in your voice, even that the possibility of that within food. Again, there's a connection to heritage.
It's a tremendous metaphor. It really is, not just actual, but it's a great metaphor for staying connected to our past through food.
Okay, so I want to move to one last ingredient that you brought here, and that's a spice mixture called za'atar. What is that mix? What is that?
Za'atar is a combination of dried wild thyme, sumac, which is a red, very sort of sour flavor. Again, the Lebanese love the sour flavors, lemony flavors like that. And then toasted sesame seeds and a little bit of salt. And this spice mix, people are really getting into making their own. I'm seeing a lot of that chatter on the blogs online. But when you can get it at Middle Eastern markets. And just to mix it with olive oil, spread it, and when you don't have the actual bread where it's been spread on and baked, which is typical, you can make a paste with the olive oil and just dip in like we are doing today.
It's so mild. It has flavor, but it's mild at the same time. I mean, it's really subtle. It's quite delightful, and it goes perfectly with the yogurt and the bread.
Very good. Very good.
So I want to real quickly. We only have just a few seconds left. But your blog, you're up in northern Michigan in the woods writing this blog, and you have this following. I mean, tell me about your online connection. I mean, there's all these comments. People are really enjoying this.
It's been a really wonderful gathering place, not only for people who are interested in Lebanese cuisine, but for people who love food and who love good writing and photography. And it's been great to gather together there with all of my friends online. And making new friends every week has been a thrill.
And they send you gifts.
And they send me presents. That's been a bonus.
That's pretty amazing. I think that's not just your recipes. I think that might be your personal touch too, Maureen.
Thanks, Joe.
Maureen Aboud is a Lansing native and a chef and writer. Her popular food blog about Lebanese cuisine is called Rosewater and Orange Blossoms. She's working on a memoir and a cookbook out of her blog post. You can see it at maureenaboud.com. Thank you, Maureen. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Joe.
Stay tuned for more Current State coming up after the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The U.S. economy grew in the first quarter of this year. The Commerce Department reports the initial read on the first quarter GDP rose 2.5%. But economist Gus Fauché with PNC Financial says it was less than expected.
That's disappointing. We were expecting something closer to 3%, and particularly given the fact that we only had 0.4% growth in the fourth quarter, we would have liked to have seen a stronger rebound in the first quarter.
Much of the gain reflects a jump in consumer spending, which rose at an annual rate of 3.2%. That's the best showing since the end of 2010. Surviving Boston Marathon bombing suspect Shahar Tsarnaev has been moved to a federal medical detention center in central Massachusetts. The U.S. Marshals Service says he was moved overnight. The facility treats federal prisoners and detainees who require specialized long-term medical or mental health care. Meanwhile, it's still not clear whether the father of the two Boston Marathon bombing suspects will begin a trip to the United States today. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports that the father has said he intends to check on his surviving son and bury the elder one.
Anzor Tsarnaev made the comment at a news conference in the southern Russian Republic of Dagestan. Both he and his former wife, Zubida Tsarnaeva, denied that their sons had any role in the attack. Tsarnaeva said that she's not planning to return to the United States at this time. It's not clear whether her decision was influenced by the fact that she's wanted in Massachusetts for jumping bail on shoplifting charges. The father of the suspect said earlier this week that he was too ill to speak to Russian and U.S. investigators. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Moscow.
The Obama administration says it appears the Syrian government has used chemical weapons against rebels on at least two occasions. But as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports, the administration is still trying to build an airtight case before deciding how to respond.
In a letter to senators, a top White House official says that the U.S. intelligence community does believe with, quote, varying degrees of confidence that the Syrian government used chemical weapons on a small scale in Syria. Senator John McCain of Arizona says that crosses the Obama administration's so-called red line.
Now I hope the administration will consider what we have been recommending now for over 2 years of this bloodletting and massacre, and that is to provide a safe area for the opposition to operate.
And McCain wants the U.S. to arm Syrian rebels. White House officials say they need more definitive proof of chemical weapons use before taking any action. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The House could vote today on a measure passed by the Senate late last night, a bill allowing the FAA flexibility in its budget, trying to stop the furloughs of air traffic controllers. Those furloughs have already caused travel headaches. On Wall Street at the open, mixed territory, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 15 points at 14,717. The Nasdaq is up 13 points at 3283. The S&P 500 down 1. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Domtar, the sustainable paper company, committed to the environmentally responsible production and use of paper. More at paperbecause.com. You can hear us on the web. Our web address is wkar.org.
Support for WKAR is provided by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.
Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, Current State producer, in for Mark Bayshore on this Friday. From Chinese prisoners to peasants in Bangladesh to POWs in the Balkans, victims of organ trafficking span the globe. Some are enticed by promises of cash payments for their kidneys and other organs. Others are forced against their will. Few of them, however, ever receive proper medical care or the money they were promised. One MSU researcher has managed to penetrate this dark underground world. Munir Munirusamin is an assistant professor of anthropology at MSU and is part of the Center for Ethics and Humanities and the Life Sciences here on campus. His is one of the first in-depth studies of people who sell their organs. His conversation with WKAR's Melissa Benmark began with how he first started researching this macabre trade in human organs.
I was a master's student in a Canadian university, so I came across to an article and it described that what is happening in India in relation to organ trafficking. So I did not believe it that these things is happening because it's a different form of bodily exploitation, unlike slavery and prostitution. So after reading that article, I decided to look into that and started doing my work. And last 15 years or so, I've been working on this issue and trying to, you know, understand how things are unfolding and changing and different directions it's taking. So that's basically triggered me to know about this underworld.
I was just reading an article from 2009, I think in Time magazine or some popular magazine, where the author was saying, oh, I just thought this was an urban legend.
And people talked it differently because there are so many movie came out and there is misconceptions about it, and it's happening not in, you know, real life. It's happening underground. So people are confused about that. And that's why there are some misconceptions came out. And that's basically, you know, they call this urban legend. But it's, you know, in my research, I interview 45 kidney sellers who already sold their bodily organs, including kidneys and livers. So, and I have all of their scars. So it's proven that, you know, you can see that this is happening in ground. It's not a legend anymore, you know.
I saw your video segment in the MSU 360, and it was excruciating because it just seemed like not only, you know, the horror of the trafficking, but the impact on entire families of what was going on.
Yeah, and that's what I found in my research, that majority of them, you know, I believe it's 81% sellers did not receive the money what they are being promised to. So for an example, one seller, he received only $600, although he was being promised that he's going to get $1,500 after giving the kidney. So none of the sellers did not receive the money beforehand, because the buyer thought that, you know, they're going to run away with that money. They live in the slums or you know, village. So they move from one area to other area. So none of them, they received the money beforehand. But after giving the kidney, the situation changed, and 80% seller did not receive the money what they are being promised. So their economic condition deteriorated. People might think that, you know, their economic condition is better off because they received the money. But what I found, their economic condition deteriorated because the money they basically pay off their loan, and they spend on material things like buying cell phone or buying a television. And so those money are gone, and now they cannot go back to their old job, like physical demanding job like rickshaw pulling or heavy industrial lifting. So their economic condition deteriorated after selling their organs. So their health condition deteriorated and their social condition declined. So all of those things happen after selling the kidney. So that didn't change their situation at all. They are living in the same condition as they were before, or they are living worse condition than they were before. So that's my finding. So selling and buying cannot change their social condition and their economic situation. So that's what this trade is an unethical trade, that it doesn't, you know, change the people's social and economic or health condition at all. So that's what one of my arguments is coming it forward, that this market is like exploitative because these people's situation didn't change at all.
Who receives the transplants?
This is mostly Bangladeshi wealthy recipients. There are cases where people living abroad, they are recipients too. And in that situation, mostly it is the Bangladeshi-born foreign nationals. Like in one case, there was a person came out from New York City, and he came to Bangladesh, and he found a seller, poor villagers, and the operation was performed in Singapore. So in those kind of situations, it's mostly Bangladeshi-born foreign national who was living in, you know, United States or Europe. So they are coming to Bangladesh too, because there's a big waiting list in those countries. And to bypass that waiting list, so these patients, they are coming to Bangladesh, and Bangladesh will be recipients too. So they are basically finding these sellers from poor villages, and then basically bringing them, either the operation is performed in Bangladesh or in India or Singapore or Thailand. So those are the countries where the operations are being performed.
I understand that you're originally from Bangladesh?
That's right. Yeah, I was born in Bangladesh, and I came to Canada for 10 years ago, did my PhD, and then came to MSU 3 years ago.
So that must be hard to see that happening, you know, in your country of origin.
Of course, and that's, you know, it's very frustrating to me that this is a situation is going on. Last 10 years, the situation didn't change at all. It's deteriorating. We are trying to work with the Ministry of Health in Bangladesh, and we are trying to work with doctors in Bangladesh to try to make some changes. And recently, I became a member of the Istanbul Declaration of Organ Trafficking, which is the World Transplantation Society. They adopted that organization. So we are working together to try to make some changes there. But it's very complicated. things are, you know, the system is very, you know, corrupt and situation is very out of, you know, our hand. And so it's really, really complicated situation.
I didn't see, and that may just because I don't know where to look, but I didn't see a lot of actual hard research like yours. Are you finding now that you're kind of one of the first and that people are kind of springing off of what you've done to do some more?
You know, my work, what there are work came out, and where Nancy Schaeffer Hughes, you know, from University of California, Berkeley, you know, she did a long-standing work. But her work is mostly global and, you know, getting different area and looking at. But my work, I really wanted to do in one you know, place, like one country, and going deeper as far as I can go. And so that's what my strength of the work is like, rather than having a, you know, snapshots or glimpse of, like, you know, how organ trafficking is happening in all over the world. I am focusing in one places and going deeper, how those phenomena are, like, you know, is all connected, and how they, you know, created a system like underworld, and then how that underworld is, like, it's so deep and so strong, and so how that exploitation is happening, how trafficking is happening. So my work is bottom up in that way, that looking at from one place and then how it become a global phenomenon.
So having exposed something like that, now do you feel like your next project is something to follow up on that, or are you going to be doing something completely different?
No, I am doing on this project, you know, for the last 13 or 14 years or so, and I'm going to keep continuing doing that. And my recent work, you know, what I'm looking at the liver trafficking, which is another new phenomena is emerging, and I already interviewed a liver seller who already sold part of his liver lobe. So liver is now become a new commodity, and part of the liver can be, you know, buy and sold on the market, in illegal market. And these poor people, you know, the broker, they convince them that, you know, liver grows faster, so you can, you know, sell part of your liver. And these poor people doesn't know what liver means and its function in the body, so these organ brokers, they convince them. And now there is a new kind of market is emerging. So I'm looking at the, you know, emerging market of liver trafficking, which is like a very, very new phenomena. There are only very few cases are, you know, documented today, mostly from the, you know, popular media. But this is my work. I'm looking at in scholarly articles that, you know, how that liver market is emerging. And I'm already interviewing. I already interviewed a liver seller, recipient, doctor. So I'm trying to understand that how that market is emerging right now. So that's my recent project.
So this really is a continuing story.
Of course, yeah. It's and how it's not only kidney, now the new medical technology and advancements of new medical technology and other body parts become a commodity. So, you know, liver is in the market right now. And my future plan is to look at, like, how surrogate tourism, where people don't have babies in the West, so they go to India and other countries, and how that exploitation is happening, where the body is intact, you know, unlike in organ trafficking. But the body is intact, but how that body become a different form of commodification is happening in relation to that body. So that is, I'm looking mostly, you know, my broader frame is like how new technology has a huge impact on the poor population. So the advancements of technology, who benefits by that and who are exploited by that.
How do you, in researching something that is so awful, how do you keep from just becoming depressed by the awfulness of it?
You know, when I looked at and I saw those stories need to be told, and these people, you know, it's kind of my obligation, in social obligation and responsibility towards those people. You know, they open up their underworld, and it's illegal. You know, some of the cases I found out, they didn't even tell to their spouses that they sold their kidneys. There is a big scar, and they came up with this story that they were working in a distant village or a city, and there was an accident happened. They had to go to the hospital. So it's shameful, humiliating, and it's illegal. So none of them, they open up their underworld, you know, like even to their spouses. So as a researcher, I try to convince them, and I listen to their story. And when I heard about that, you know, I thought, you know, I need to tell that story. This is a severe form of exploitation. It's unseen in human history. And that's the motivation I have, and I'm working on it.
That was WKAR's Melissa Benmark with Munir Munirizamin, an assistant professor of anthropology at MSU. Professor Munirizamin's work was presented in a video segment as part of the Spartans Will 360 report. You can find a link to it on our website at wkar.org. MSU is home to the largest library comic collection in the world. Scholars from all over make the journey to the basement of the university's main library to analyze the works. Kern State's Emmanuel Berry joined Randy Scott, who was in charge of the collection, for a tour. Scott explains that the collection started after an MSU professor made a donation.
In 1970, thereabouts, 69 or 70, that school year, a professor named Russell Nye was teaching a popular culture course and writing a book on popular culture, and he decided he would donate the comics that came out of that experience and that he strong-armed his students into donating. And so 6,000 comics came popping in here in 1970, and nobody knew what to do with them. I wasn't here. I didn't get here till 74, at which time somebody stole Spider-Man number one. I was upstairs as a typist. I wasn't working down here. Mm-hmm. But when I heard that, I read that in the state news. I came down here and volunteered. I said, we need to do some security. And so we figured out a ownership stamp to put on all the comics so the dealers wouldn't resell them right away if somebody else did this. Nothing's been stolen since. That's 1973, yeah.
Where did the comics in this collection come from? Where are they at country-wise? And, yeah, where do you get your comics from?
Well, they're still 90% or more donated, and I get tons. I'm leaning against a big donation right now. And every year, especially around tax time, somebody who's got a big collection tends to turn up with several thousand comics. 10,000 would be a good average number for a good December. They do all the paperwork, and they take a tax deduction, and we're off and running. I've got a year's work. Our collection is from all over the world, and we also have things about comics, books about comics, magazines about comics, and that's where I spend the money. I do have a budget. And I buy foreign comics, and I buy things that are about comics, because those don't tend to get donated.
Who uses this collection? Is it mainly students coming down here, and what are they using the collection for?
Well, our largest number of users is MSU undergrads, and that's, of course, our mission, is to service the MSU community. Some of them are just here for recreation. That's not actually that often. They come here because there's a comic. More and more, there are classes that are requiring comics be read. Ooh, that's so amazing to me, because when I started this, there were only two books about comic books ever written, and one of them was against them, saying that they were evil and they were like drugs. And now there's a new book about comics at least every month. And if you count books from France and Italy and Spain, there's a book a week coming out about comics. Big, solid, many of them academic press books about comics. And a good handful of those have been written or partly written here. People come from all over the world to read our comics and to study them and to write their books or their dissertations. So that's the second most interesting group of users. There's the undergrads who do their stuff, they write their term papers, or they enjoy their Batman, which there's nothing wrong with that. I'm really for that. And then there are the scholars who get a little grant and come here from wherever. We've had a couple of young students from France and England over the last year. And their perspective on our comics is, interesting to me. Because they were here to look at 1950s comics, and I hadn't really realized that those would be so important in their studies of what the Cold War was like and what society was like during the 1950s. That's why I've been buying a lot of 1950s comics lately.
Can we take a little look at the collection?
We just got a nice box of North Korean comics. Can you believe it?
North Korean comics? What are they? Have you looked at any of them yet?
Oh,
what
yeah,
are they
right.
like?
We can walk by them. They're a mixture. There's fantasy and there's history and there's, I don't know what I expected, but I can't read a word, but there's quite a variety. We've got about 40 of them.
So, yeah, I ran out of space. So here's where the North Korean comics ended up. And, you know, I don't know. I don't.
Well, we got the U.S. here. This guy's on the cover, and it looks like he's in pain.
American soldier, he's sweating blood, I would have to
say. Yeah, that's what it looks like.
And there's a lot of swords.
A lot of swords. This one looks maybe a little romantic, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Well, we need a Korean cataloger. There are lots of people who could help me translate this, but I would like to get it done professionally so we can have, you know, what we call full-level cataloging, so we can really tell the world that we have it and we know what it is.
Yeah, and someone could come and
I don't know what it is.
Come and write a book about Korean culture through comic books.
Oh,
come to MSU.
Sure. Yeah, we've got hundreds of South Korean comics, so, you know, we're ready for you. Here's one of the favorite French westerns. That's Lieutenant Blueberry.
Okay.
Blueberry. This is in English. Okay. This is an English version. But, you know, there we are in the web. That's the, you know, we open the book. It's got to be, I think they're talking northern Mexico, but it looks like the landscape of the Four Corners area in New Mexico. This is called the Blue Coats. Let's see if I can find one in English. Yeah, there's an English one.
The Navy Blues.
It takes place during the Civil War. But it is a Western in that they're always roaming around away from the battlefield doing Western-type stuff.
What is Europe's obsession with the American West? In Germany they have Captain, Winnetou and...
Winnetou.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. That's Karl May was like one of the most successful kids authors of German literature. And a lot of his stories have been translated, the Western ones particularly. He wrote stuff about everywhere in the world. They've been translated into comics, mostly by people in Belgium and Spain, not by Germans, but they sell well in Germany. So, yeah, Karl May, Winnetou, we have lots of Winnetou.
Nach dem sensationellen Erfolg der beiden ersten Winnetou-Filme erleben Sie nun den absoluten Höhepunkt. Einer der schönsten Erzählungen von Karl May. Winnetou steht gemeinsam mit den Häuptlingen befreundeter Stämme.
What's one of the oldest comics you have in here?
We have something from the 1840s.
1840s.
According to most Europeans and a lot of scholars the world around, comics started in Switzerland in the 1840s by a guy named Rudolf Töpfer, who was a novelist and a travelogue writer and a playwright and an all-around, you know, literary guy. He got this idea that he would publish these little books. They were basically pictures with a few captions, and they were silly stories. And they were self-published as books, just like, almost like we think of as comic books. And we are lucky enough to have somewhere about here... You're supposed to look in the catalog when you look for comics. You're not supposed to come running in here and expect to find things.
I trust you, though. You're the expert.
So this one, 18 question mark. We don't know, I guess, exactly when this was published. It was probably rebound. I don't think it had this hardcover binding when it was first published. I'm sure it didn't.
Oh, wow.
Well, this is what his stories looked like, and this was... collected by the grandfather of a professor in 1893 on a trip to Paris, and his grandson donated them to us in the late 1950s. But there is some idea that the first comic book published in America may have been a translation of one of his works. Yeah, also done in the 1840s. We don't have that, but we have a facsimile of that sitting here somewhere.
Wow.
And at some point, a light should come on so we can get in there.
There we go.
And we're now in the golden age. These are comic books that started in the 30s and 40s. In three, and we walk right past Wonder Woman.
This is the first issue of Wonder Woman.
Nope. That's what it looks like. Take a picture.
Now, what's your story, lady?
Story? Well, I know a few myths, but...
Oh, a joker, huh? Okay. Suppose we start with your name.
Wonder Woman.
Sure. That's the last name. Woman? first name Wonder, right?
There's a certificate of insurance. It was taken out for an exhibit at some time. In 2004, it was insured. Oh, summer 42. It was insured for $1,000.
Wow.
If it was Superman, it'd be a million. You know, there's sexism there.
Yeah.
But. Excuse me, but that's very rude.
Get out of here, broad.
It's also dangerous. Please put those guns down.
And where does your personal connection and love for comics stem from?
Oh, I read Batman as a kid, and I was encouraged to read everything. So, you know, I wasn't discouraged from reading comics. I never heard about anti-comics programs or anything like that when I was a kid. It was just not a question. So, then I outgrew them, but then at one point I needed a job, and I got a job in a comic book store across the street working for Ray Walsh, who still owns the Curious Bookshop. But it had a comics, for many years it had a comics section. It's got a small one again now, but I was the first manager, quote-unquote, of the comic section of that bookstore. And I realized this was a lot of fun. And when I also realized I couldn't live on the wages they paid, I moved over here. And that's when Spider-Man number one was stolen. Then the rest, you know, I figured I was motivated. I had the skills from the bookstore and just kept working on it.
You were never discouraged to read about reading comics as a kid, and you never really saw an anti-comic sentiment. But there is kind of a, not anti-comic, but they're not looked at necessarily in the same vein as literature or great art when it is great literature and it is great art. Do you think attitudes have changed or shifted at all?
In general, attitudes have basically changed away from the whole idea that comics are some kind of evil thing that are going to rot your mind, and, you know, literally people compared comics to all kinds of drugs and stuff in the 50s. But the attitude that comics are trivial is still well with us in people of the older generation. I'm 65. My generation has accepted comics pretty much, but those old geezers, you know, they're still having trouble with it.
And that was Randy Scott. He's the assistant head of the library's special collections. He spoke with Kern State Emmanuel Berry about MSU's diverse comic book art collection. Coming up on Kern State Weekend, host Emmanuel Berry will preview this summer's crop of new films. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and you've been listening to Kern State on WKAR.